Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Genetics Podcast. I'm really excited to be here today with Julia Taravella, who's the Executive Director of the Rare Trait Hope Fund. And Julia, you established the Rare Trait Hope Fund due to your family's very personal experience with an ultra-rare disease. And from my perspective, you've really significantly moved the needle towards developing a gene therapy. I would love if you could just talk us through the origin of how you decided to change from a career in an entirely different field and dedicate what seems like it's been a very productive couple of years of your life to making a really important difference. We're going to talk today about the ultra rare and rare disease drug development process from a very different perspective rather than from a biotech or pharma perspective, from a nonprofit and ultimately parents' perspective of taking this mission on personally. So welcome, and I'd love if we could just start with that origin story.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. It's an exciting time for us now in the development of our nonprofit and all about the drug that we've been trying to bring to the clinical trial and hopefully eventually to the market. Our story started a long time ago. And it's not only the development of the drug, it's also the beginning is actually the diagnosis of the people and children with ultra-rare diseases. I always noticed that my son, Daniel, having some kind of developmental issue. They were not very well defined. And in the end, I actually call it, he has a non-dramatic disease. What it means that I don't bring him to emergency room. I don't bring him to extreme, to psychiatrist, psychologist, or anything like that. The dramatic medicine, where they will say, okay, the child has seizures, the child have heart failure, and they can diagnose the disease. It's a slow progressing developmental disorder. So I remember my first thought came something that was not right whenever he was about 10 months old. Me and my friend, we had kids within week difference, and her son was a week older than mine. And then we met one time whenever the kids were 10 months old, and her son was like sitting, crawling, and doing all kinds of whatever 10-year-olds do before starting to walk. And my son just barely was sitting down. So it was, and okay. And everybody, I remember I talked to a pediatrician about that, and he dismissed that, saying, okay, the slow development.
Yeah.
Yes, it is slow development. And that's how it happened through years. He stopped talking. Well, not stopped talking. He kind of had the spurs of conversation and then it slowed down in about 2.5 years old. So, and it's the doctor always said it's normal because it was the low range of normality. But almost in everything else, it was like that. It's all speech, talk, walk, kind of stuff like that. But when my next child, also another son, was born 5 years later, whenever he was 6 months old, I kind of noticed exactly the same behavior. So, and I start searching for whatever it is. And I mean, he had tons of diagnosis from, you know, ADHD, auditory processing disorder, or all those learning development profiles problems. But nothing came up on that. And by the time my oldest son was, I would say like 15, 16 years old. So think about it. It's like this thing is like whole life. Wow. And putting the pressure on the parents, on their close relatives, knowing that something wrong with the child, but you cannot figure it out what it is. And my poor older son, because his, the way his presentation is a little bit worse than the younger one. And maybe because I put the younger one in all of those development classes, you know, at 6 months old when I noticed that. My oldest son, I mean, we did so many tests on him. I mean, probably in a year, they would draw like hundreds of vials of blood trying to figure out all kinds of tests. But muscle biopsy, whole body x-rays, and all kinds of testing like this type of testing, you know, like very invasive testing. Like they drew spine fluid several times, but nothing worked. So by the time he was 15, the doctors are saying like, look, you need to stop. You need to stop that and get you know, in peace and try just to accept that you will never find out. So that was early 2000s, and you probably appreciate that. That's what I did is 23andMe just came out. So I started with just doing, and that was, remember the pricing was like $800 a piece. And I remember we did the whole whatever testing for me and my husband, because it was expensive, $800, like 20 years ago, it was expensive. So we did that for both of us. Nothing came out. Then, okay, like maybe 6 months later, I was able to get enough money to test the rest of the family. So including my kids, the living grandparents and stuff like that. The funny part that also nothing came up, nothing popped out that will present with the disease. So what I start looking at, I mean, it's kind of crazy. And looking back, I think I probably was obsessed.
Yeah.
I was trying to figure out. So what I did is, thanks for my whole engineering background. So I have double major chemistry and chemical engineering. So what I start looking at is genetics. Most of those genetic companies now and back then offering, you can download raw data. So I downloaded raw data. What I did is I generated hypothetical child between me and my husband and compare the hypothetical child or children, because there are several options can be, to my real children. That's the way I found the problem. It is, so you probably will appreciate that. It was the genes of interest, let's say, they had a deletion. And so that's when you read that, so that's how you can figure it out. So I guess I was lucky. So finally, I was lucky like 16 years after.
It's incredible. So effectively, you made your own diagnosis. Did you then take it to that same doctor who said you should stop looking?
I took to all of the doctors. So when I got the diagnosis, the killed, like, but it's like the crazy parent doing that, you know? So I had to actually prove, but then I went back to the doctors. I said that I want to test specifically that disease. Because all of those testings that was done for 15 years for my kids actually did not do whole exome sequencing, which was extremely expensive at that time, a whole genome for that extent, you know. They were testing for one specific disease or for the panels or for this and that. And that was the problem, because we never could figure it. I mean, there are 7,000, 10,000 rare diseases. You cannot get the panels for those 10,000 rare diseases. And AGU still almost in none of the panels.
Well,
so
maybe for the benefit as well, it's incredibly rare. There are probably a couple hundred individuals around the world diagnosed. But one of the things I wanted to point out that I thought was an interesting, maybe a call out for the importance of sequencing people in diverse databases and parts of the world, is I think AGU is one of the examples of what you call Finnish heritage disease, right? So it's much more common in Finland, for example, because of the founder effect of the population. And so I guess there was some things known about the disease because of work done in Finland, right? But it's much, much rarer in other parts of the world. So like you mentioned, not commonly analyzed on panels. Is that right?
The interesting part is, and I think that's actually representative to a lot of rare diseases, what I see now, what like publication said that it is indeed, and I fully agree, it is Finnish heritage disease. It is actually one of the most common rare diseases in Finland, but it is published that way. Now that we're researching more and more, we found in several populations that actually has a lot more prevalence than Finnish, but it's not published because we don't know so much about those ultra-rare diseases. We're taking it. And that's why I remember actually, so finally my kids got the final diagnosis from the doctor, because AGU, what we finally have is the disease that's called aspartyl glucosaminouria. For short, we'll call it AGU for the sake of everybody. It is lysosomal storage disorder. And indeed it was always called Finnish heritage disease. And I remember testing my kids on that for in like 2008. And the results came, actually, the results came back false negative. And the biggest reason for this false negative results is because nobody was testing that in the United States. So they didn't have the standard for the testing. It is urine testing. And I remember doctors saying that, well, what happened with the results is the results came back, the urine is, the sample is contaminated. And I remember talking to the doctors like, look, I'm a chemist. That's my that's my job to make non-contaminated samples. But I've been working like in the lab, you know.
Oh my gosh.
He said that, first of all, it's a Finnish heritage disease. And number two, he said that you really don't want your child to have that disease. There's no treatment. So yeah, that's kind of funny.
Wow. And so you said, rather than bury my head in the sand and say, I don't want it to be this, that this is the truth. And so you tell me about how you then started to think about raising money, and you've raised quite a bit of money to pursue therapy development for this ultra rare disease. And I'd love to hear about, did you consider different routes? Like maybe I partner with a biotech company or I start a nonprofit. How did you go about deciding to take the route that you did?
So once we kind of got over our grieving and depression, because it's really hits your heart when you realize that your children have fatal disease. I mean, no parent want to hear that. And so once you kind of get over it, and that is a very important part of the grieving process. And out of that, from what I see now, the parents come out, the parents with their children with those type of diseases come out in two ways. And I guess it's just human nature. Everybody out of stress and out of the distress coming out of into one of them will say, okay, that's what my life for me. I will now like grieve on that forever and ever. And the outcome of that, like they really don't do anything. They just kind of accept that, you know, that everybody needs to feel sorry for them. And that's very understandable. And the other type of parents, and I have in like, I would say that people who are developing the drug have to deal with all of that. That's how you, like you're getting patients, and it's very difficult to get patients like that, that have that attitude. And then there is a parents that's actually, I would say probably me. And there is a few other parents that we got together in a very tight group. And that's also the very different kind of totally different type of parents, very different. They want to get into every single detail on that. That's also for like, let's say biotech and pharmaceutical companies, very difficult to deal with because those parents want to be everywhere. But for me, ultra-rare disease is kind of looking around. What I find out back in 2012, I kind of look out the whole field of what's going on with HU. And what I found out that thanks to that kind of the study in Finland, they studied that disease for quite a while, for like 10, 20 years, 30 years. They actually did enzyme replacement therapy in mice, and it showed extremely good results. But they were never, so the pharmaceutical company that tried to develop enzyme replacement therapy never were able to figure out how to make their enzymes on a large scale. So that stopped. They tried bone marrow replacement, and then didn't work too good. The results didn't come out well. They tried actually gene therapy. And before 2000, and results also came out in mice. The results also came out pretty well. But at that time, they tried adenovirus and they stopped it because of lack of funding. So by 2000, most of the research stopped completely. Going to Finland was like my first thing to go, trying to figure out what's going on there. So I went, we went with everybody, like with the kids. And at the same time, the Finnish doctor who did a lot of work, Dr. Maria Arvio, she's the one that kind of studied the disease and published the natural history of the Finnish disease, Finnish mutation of the disease, I would say. So she invited us, but also invited one other family, French family, also that just got diagnosed a few months before that. And that probably was the first ally for the development that I met. One of the things is that when we went over there, their approach, because they studied the disease so much, so their approach to the disease, we'll get the diagnosis for you prenatally. So you will not have any more children. Or if you are interested, you can have abortion or something like that. But we will help you with the child, taking care of child. So there is a social kind of social, I would say that, like help put in place in Finland to help in with raising the children with AGU or with those kind of dramatic diseases, developmental diseases, neurological diseases. But it's, and I remember sitting with their French family, we're sitting in them in a restaurant just to get to know each other and talking. I was like, I'm not ready just to give up and rely on the social security system for my children for the rest of their lives. It's like, I want to do something. And they was like, yeah, we'll be with you. Just tell us what to do. And after that, I actually did, so my background, and at that time I did full-time, I actually had a full-time job. My background is in project development, early stages project development. So I've been doing that. First, I worked in the consultant company, and then I worked at the large oil production company. But the approach to the project development was always the same, almost in every company that I worked with in the consultant, and then through the partnership in my with my employee. So the way how I approach that is exactly the same. First of all, and that's very interesting point, is never put two eggs in a basket, in one basket. Oh, you never put what is called?
Your eggs in one basket, yeah.
Yeah. So what I did is I actually had a small gathering for within like 2 months. I had a small gathering of the experts in project development and AGU. We had the meeting in Germany, and I just wanted to brainstorm what therapies are possible for AGU based on the past experience. I didn't want just to actually focus on only one therapy. What if it will fail? What it will get delayed? So I really wanted to get help for my kids. So what we did is we went through all of the possible routes for gene therapy. I mean, for genetic diseases. There's not too many of them, actually. Probably 10 most, you know.
Right, a dozen or so, yeah, that you can...
Yeah, like exactly. I mean, it's some type of gene therapy. I mean, it's some types of gene and cell therapies. Variations of that, because everything else that you do, it's not actually the cure, it's just the treatment of the symptoms. So what we went through, I remember we talked about bone replacement therapy, gene therapy, enzyme replacement therapy, and something that interesting that came up that's called chaperone or small molecule therapy. So, and as a result of that meeting, going to that meeting was, we need to pick up two therapies. I don't want to focus only one. As a result of that meeting, what we came up is we choose two therapies. And one of them was small molecule therapy and another one was gene therapy. And that's one of the things, now looking back, I think it's the big differentiations between, let's say, parent foundations that trying to find the cure for their children versus a pharmaceutical company that trying to find a specific treatment or cure for the disease. You almost never see pharmaceutical company that do this and that for the same disease. But to me, it's like, I think it's actually a pretty good approach for ultra-rare diseases because you really don't know what will happen.
Yes, that's right. And what have you found? I mean, what are the early signals suggest? Are both routes potential? Have you learned more about one compared to the other?
Of course. So once we identified the path forward, what I did is I literally kind of gathered the people around the world that, who are willing to work with me. So kind of long story short, the researcher developed, she did a marvelous job. She developed small molecule therapy. And luckily, so my children had deletion on one side, and you really cannot do small molecule therapy on the large pieces of gene deletion. But the other one was mutation, like standard mutation. And that's what she focused and she worked on with. And she actually found the small molecule, the drug for that, probably within like a year to year and a half, something like that, extremely fast. And my goal for those small molecules, and I remember, and there's also lots of talks right now with specifically with pharmaceutical company whose goal is to make money on that. So I remember when we talked about our approach to trying to find the drug or small molecule for different mutations is actually we were going to do the drug screen panels in Harvard. That was one of our kind of workings. Before that, actually, when we were waiting in line, because at that time, like it was over 6 months or a year waiting period, I asked her to actually screen off-the-shelf natural component and see if this is a possibility for us to find something. And that's actually what we found. What we found is, so it's not only found for my kid's mutation, but it's found for like 4 or 5 other mutations. So what she found out is there is a natural compound exists that's off-the-shelf. That's the safety data exists. That I can buy it almost right away. I went with all of the work that she did to the geneticist. A geneticist looked at that and she said, okay, we can start them on that. That's not a problem, you know. And we will do the test on their kind of just their metabolic disease test. And that's what, so I remember, I think 2 years after diagnosis, my kids already was taking the small molecule. So, and another drug also off the shelf is given to, actually is following the clinical trial protocol in Finland because it's a Finnish mutation. So there is more children with that. I think there is in that clinical trial and they are about to actually finalize the clinical trial. I think it's 4 years, which is actually pretty good results and lots of learnings from that we will be using in our.
So tell me the drive to do a gene therapy in addition, because it sounds like the small molecule is quite a bit of promise there, but maybe it doesn't does not work for everybody.
Of course it doesn't work for everybody. It works is probably out of the patient population wise, it works only less than 50%. I mean, it works on Finnish mutation. That's why there is a big part of that. But for everybody else, it's probably only 20% of population. So what the other thing is, I mean, we were hoping to bring gene therapy. I found the researchers that will be doing gene therapy. We started the funding, we bought the mice. Everything that was done was funded by us or another parents organizations globally that we worked with in different countries. Gene therapy, AGU, the gene that is responsible for AGU called AGA. It is very small gene, means that it fits in AAV. So we are doing gene therapy with standard AAV9 virus carrier. The researchers developed the construct, the plasmid, and the vector pretty quick within a couple of months. Produced enough to use in mice for efficacy studies. It took a few extra years to get good, consistent results because lots of people work with AAV viruses and mice gene therapies, but 12 years ago, it was not too many. There was only a few people that was doing that. So actually, the learning process and get consistent results took extra couple of years. And in, I think, 2018, yes, in January 2018, we went to FDA with pre-IND. Everything was finished. And pre-IND was actually, we had a pretty good result. One of the also learnings for me now, like once we're going to do next diseases, it's actually definitely do pre-IND meetings with FDA. What it gave us, ability to save a lot of money because the standard process, and once you read in the FDA documents, you go from your efficacy study, you produce in the drug, and then you do toxicology. And toxicology, you do in primates, non-human primates. It is a lot of money. But once you present the data and maybe do certain studies with the mice, like long-term safety data you can do with the mice, FDA will let you, might or might not, but if you ask, it will happen. If you will never ask, it will never happen. So as a result of that, we were actually allowed to use rat in our toxicology study, not non-human primate, which is, I mean, saved us probably a million plus.
What else did you learn from that process? Sounds like you're going to apply, and I'm interested to hear what other disease you're thinking about applying it to as well, because it sounds like you're not stopping with AGU.
Yeah. So we had the meeting in January 2018. And right after that, we got an interest from pharmaceutical company. And pharmaceutical, just like you're saying, that pharmaceutical company came along and signed their license agreement to bring the gene therapy into clinical trial. And at that time, actually, their timeline was to start clinical trial probably 2020, 2021, something like very fast. Of course, you want to bring that, you know, But after 3 years of kind of looking at the data and going back and studying natural history study and kind of reevaluating everything, looking for patients, the pharmaceutical company decided to drop the disease. And so you probably know it very well. It was like 21, 22. There was several pharmaceutical companies that once the economic downfall hits, yes, lots of company cuts down the development. And I remember in my professional times, we did that lots of times. We always something that's called, we always were looking for low-hanging fruit. And those rare diseases are extremely low-hanging fruit. So once it is any kind of economic distress, the rare diseases will be the first one to cut off, will be the first one to drop. And I think it's a good thing for the rare disease. On one side, on a good time, when pharmaceutical company taking on rare disease, it's not their highest priority. So in good times, the pharmaceutical company will do the development of rare diseases, but they will, and I'm talking about larger pharmaceutical company that has a bigger development. Their priority is on that large profitable development. Rare diseases, if it will break even and give some extra money, you know, that's good. It's never a huge profitable development. I'm talking about ultra-rare disease, by the way, which is the majority, like, whatever, 90% of their rare diseases are ultra-rare diseases. So in the good economic times, the pharmaceutical company is progressing it, but progressing it slow. And then they will drop it. They will be the first one to drop. To me, is if the group of parents or group of, let's say, entrepreneurs that want to develop that on for profit basis, but want to focus only for ultra-rare disease, it's very good for them to work on. You can get, just like you're saying, that there is a lot of benefit by developing those ultra-rare diseases, which will come at the later stage in the development, you usually know it. But then for us, it is extremely difficult to do fundraising. We never got, as the nonprofit foundation, I think we got only one grant. Everything else, the money that was raised was purely on grassroots fundraising. And that parents put in events and entertainment nonstop. I remember in our early days whenever we were just one of two parent groups between us and French people. I think for 5 years we did fundraising. I mean, we were putting events in New Orleans like four or five times every year for years. It is extremely exhausting.
Yeah, I can only imagine.
But once you progress more and more, kind of you learn all of that, you know, and you learn how to negotiate all of the cost estimates, all of the contracts. You learn all of that. And you find the companies who are extremely interested in you, want to help. Like a few of the companies, when we start producing the drug, gave us huge donations, hundreds of thousands of dollars, not in money, but in kind donation. Let's say if the contract was $300,000, we end up paying, I think, $80,000. The rest, the company wrote off, you know, because as a nonprofit, we can provide tax receipts, tax breaks, and things like that. And some of the companies that's making a profit will be interested in those tax breaks. So yeah, that's kind of, I think the journey of the ultra-rare disease development for with nonprofit or some extremely small for-profit fund company is very different for large or medium-sized pharmaceutical company.
To leave our listeners with a couple of questions or takeaways here, there are two ones that I have. One is, first, how can people help you to take the next step on this journey? It sounds like it's been a little bit of a two steps forward, one step back, and you have extreme perseverance, and I have nothing but admiration for you continuing to make progress. I know people can visit your website, which we'll put a link in the chat as well, but it's just raretrade.com, and can make a donation directly to help. But what other things, like what are you looking for? Partners or people who can help you take it to the next level? And then I've got one other question to close out with after that. Yeah.
Well, it's parents. And it's not only me, there are several other groups of parents that's working in exactly the same situation as us. It's always our foundation. But specifically me, I remember talking to somebody yesterday, and the person was one of the summer interns. I interviewed right now for summer interns. And I specifically told him that, look, this is also my learning journey. What we're doing right now is, we've finished we actually done the drug production, which we still are paying for it. We still don't have enough money. I think we paid like 60%. We still need to have 40%. I think it's all on the website. The toxicology study is done. So actually right now we're in the process of putting paperwork for IND. We're going to apply for IND sometimes within the next couple months, and then IND clearance, and then RIB and starting clinical trial. All of that is the complete new journey for me and for everybody that's working with me. We never done that. So that's one of the things that the biggest help is actually teaching us and holding our hands. If there is no donations, that's the other thing that can be done that's extremely, extremely important. It's like the stuff that you are doing, you're putting out those webinars and kind of explaining the steps, what needs to be done, you know, teaching people, that is extremely important. So think about it. There is a group of parents acting as a pharmaceutical company without training. Think about it. What you would do if you get new employees in the company without the training, the first thing you would do is actually provide training for them. It would be so good to kind of set up some kind of, I don't know, like, it's not a podcast, it's not a webinar, but some kind of school for parents who wants to develop their drug. Yes. And to me, there are 7,000 diseases that don't have a treatment. There are plenty of diseases to share. There is a plenty of work to do for everybody, you know, that's almost. And if anybody will provide their expertise, okay, you go this way, that's how you do. Step this, this, and this. That's all I need.
I might be able to help you. There's a group that, if you're not connected with them already, I'll share right now, because I think they do incredible work. They're based in my backyard here in Cambridge, UK, but it's a nonprofit called Beacon. It's Beacon for Rare Diseases. And the website is rarebeacon.org. And what they do that is really different and incredible is they're a nonprofit that is focused around solving this problem. to help nonprofits, rare, you know, family-founded rare disease charities to go on that journey from early discovery, we've just got a diagnosis and we don't know where to start, all the way through to, I think, where you are now and designing clinical trials, submitting. So I'll connect you with them directly, but yeah, I think they're an amazing charity. That my second question was actually going to be, what advice do you have for families that are maybe early on in this journey and thinking about starting a nonprofit, or they've already started one, or they're part of one and they're trying to do what you've done and make a difference and get this further along, just so it's de-risked for someone to come along, I think, and help you take that final step, which ultimately you want to get this to patients around the world. But so yeah, what advice would you have for someone who's in that position, maybe 4 or 5 years earlier than where you are today?
I think the best advice that I was given, that I want to kind of share, was given to my math by my math teacher at school. And she usually always would say, if you want to solve a problem, if you don't know what to do, do something. And that's the biggest differentiator I've seen within parents groups that achieve something. It's the groups that actually do something. And it doesn't matter. You will make mistakes. It doesn't matter. You will make mistakes. You will go over it, but you will learn from that mistake. And yeah, that's, but if you don't do something, you know, if you would feel that there is nothing, like lots of people, I don't know that, you know, there's lots of, I don't know how to do that. I don't know where to start. Start somewhere. Start reading, you know, there is lots of basic information out there. But also, like you're saying, that I didn't know about those, but I also don't know a lot about nonprofit kind of outside US. But yeah, that's great. You know, that's great. That's the resource. But like in the United States, there are several other kind of organizations that provide initial help, initial. But yeah, just go out. Just go out, meet people, and try to figure out what is your comfortable space, whether you want to be an advocate and kind of spread the word about the disease. If you want to be somewhere who facilitates the research, who brings people together, who works, who kind of brings team together, or maybe a few people that I know of that they actually went back to the lab and start doing the work by themselves because they have that background.
Yes.
But to me, it's like there is a space, there is so much space for everybody in individualized medicine.
Yes.
It's not even funny.
Yeah, and I think you made the great point and example earlier of using your own skills. Like you have done complex project management, and so you almost started with that hat on. Like, look, I've done this in my life, and I know this is a complex project we're about to embark on. So how do I use those skills? I think that's a good lesson for anybody. Use what you've got and start there and do something, right?
Yeah. Well, somebody, I mean, there's so many little things can be done around that. So essentially you are building the totally new industry and organization. There is a, like nobody in the world right now figure out how to develop treatments for ultra-rare diseases. Everybody's out there trying to figure out their economic models, their funding models, like governments, NIH in the United States, you know, like in Europe. And everybody's trying to help you. So it's like, but nobody knows how to solve that. So to me, it's like the more people, the merrier. We can all work together and everybody have different skills. I benefited so much from the skills of the other people and learn from that. It's amazing. I appreciate those and those relations and those friendships. It's unbelievable.
Well, thank you for taking the time to do this, but also for dedicating so much of your life to this incredibly important cause. I think you've taught everybody who listened something today about the power of perseverance and also what one person or group of motivated people can do to make a difference. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
And as always, thanks everyone for listening to the podcast. If you have any feedback, you can reach us anytime. And we always appreciate you sharing the podcast with a friend or leaving us a review on your favorite podcast player if you enjoyed it. So thanks again, and we'll see you next time.